ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
ABC Cricket Podcast time with one of your boys, Corbin Middlemouse, with you. There is no Ed Cowan today, but as always, when Ed's not here, I always have a very suitable replacement. And one man who I'm particularly fond of his work, you'll hear me reference him often, I'm sure, on this podcast. He is a writer, an analyst, a senior correspondent with ESPN Crick Info. And he's over in India at the moment, in Mumbai, covering the IPL, which is unusual for someone from a Sena nation that's born in another part of the world to be so heavily into the IPL. And yet he's a T20 specialist. He knows all about the tactics and everything that's going on in the T20 game. So we thought, who better to come on and be able to break it all down for us for an Australian audience that might be dipping in and out of the IPL? His name is Matt Roller from ESPN Crick Info. Matt, appreciate your time.
Not at all. I hope to do my best Ed Cowan impression. I got, I think, about 10,000 fewer first class runs, but hopefully be able to offer the listeners something.
Just a little bit on yourself, firstly. So you're a young man, but you've already done so much in the journalism game. It feels like a lot of, as I said in the intro, you know, from the Sena nation, sort of South Africa, England, New Zealand, Australia, it feels like a lot of people almost have this hostility towards T20 cricket. So you buck the trend a little bit that you're particularly fond of it and are great in your analysis of the shortest format of the game. What is it about T20 cricket that grabbed you in a way that perhaps hasn't grabbed so many others from the same background?
I think it's probably two things, Corb. I think, firstly, I've probably always had a relatively mathematical type brain and approach to following cricket, as I'm sure a lot of fans do. But I think T20 really lends itself to that. And secondly, I guess, just in terms of age and location, I was, 10 years old when the IPL started in 2008, and it being on in the UK when it was, generally games starting at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So very different to your audience in Australia, where it's on in the middle of the night. We had four seasons from 2010 to 2013, where it was the only cricket on live free-to-air TV in the UK. And you could stream it on YouTube as well. So I think during that period where you had guys like Chris Gayle, AB de Villiers, Kieran Pollard smacking it all over the place, I very much have always been into the IPL, always enjoyed it. And yeah, it's been fantastic over the past probably four seasons now to get a good chance to get stuck in over here in India.
It's undoubtedly the number one cricket league in the world every year. The best players from all over the globe obviously make their way to India to play in this two-month-long tournament. I've often said I don't understand why we as cricket fans don't appreciate it, certainly in Australia, the same way that we appreciate, you know, leagues like the NBA, for example, in America, or even, you know, Premier League football in the UK, for example. A lot of Australians have a Premier League side. It's on in the middle of the night, so can't even really use that excuse that, you know, the time zone's not that friendly. Why is it, do you think, that Australians or, you know, cricket fans perhaps from other corners of the globe haven't rallied around this tournament in the same way that we see in other sports where there's, you know, there's quite clearly a Premier League?
It's a good question. I guess maybe there's a novelty aspect to it in that it's still relatively new. You know, we're sub 20 years. A lot of these franchises, you know, you had an expansion a couple of years ago. I think there's a certain fatigue to the IPL at times as well. I think because of the format being quite different to most sports leagues, and that you have a single game or up to two games per day rather than there being a weekend that you can follow. You know, if you were an Australian fan who was really invested in how Pat Cummins and the Sunrisers were doing, that would be a lot of different nights of the week at various times. It's not a point to view in the same way as, I suppose, Premier League football on Saturdays and Sundays. But yeah, it'll be curious to see how that evolves over time, and whether there's a generation that comes through in Australia. You know, feels unlikely right now, but who knows? Maybe an 8-year-old, 9-year-old who's getting into cricket back home at the moment for you guys will, in 15 years' time, be a diehard Gujarat Titan based on how an Australian player's done for them. It might sound dystopian to some, but who knows?
One story that has grabbed headlines here is Travis Head's involvement with Virat Kohli. So we've got the usual cricketing villain in Virat, particularly in these parts up against, you know, the most beloved Australian cricketer at the moment in Travis Head. Saw they were jawing at each other and going at it the other night in the game between RCB and the Sunrisers. Just break it down for us, Matt. What on earth happened between the pair?
It's a good question, and I doubt we'll ever know the full story. There was clearly a bit of a flashpoint because you could see when Kohli and Head were sort of lining up for a handshake, there was another row of Sunrisers coaching staff that we're all looking over in anticipation as to whether or not Coley and Head would shake hands, and a few gasps when it didn't happen. It seemed like something was said at some point in the middle by Head that wound Virat up, because he went at him quite a bit. Head quite often is the beneficiary of the impact substitution over here, which means that he bats and doesn't field. And I think Virat then made a couple of gestures in his way, firstly doing the X, which is the impact player symbol, saying, you know, surprised to see you out on the field. And then he gave him a bit of a an off spin gesture mimic, as though saying, you know, are you going to come on and bowl? Head did later come on and bowl and get the wicket of Rajat Patidar, the RCB captain. Admittedly, the game was done by that point. But yeah, definitely one to watch, because those two teams can meet again in the finals, depending on how results go. So be interested to see what the relationship between those two is like.
So you very kindly highlighted some themes, which I think is the best way to do it. I mean, a lot of people that probably follow it down here will be thinking it's all just a whole lot of scores and scorecards, and every now and then they'll recognise a name or come across, obviously, one of the Australians that are involved in various of these teams. But before we get to that, just as a broad overview, the Aussie guys that have grabbed your attention, we have slightly more than a dozen players that are there at the moment. Not all of them playing, it must be said, at this particular stage. But was there one name that came through during the tournament where you thought, wow, that guy's kind of made me change my mind on what I think he's capable of?
I tell you what, I think over the past 5 games that he's actually been here, Josh Inglis has been an absolute revelation for Lucknow at the top of the order. They've had a pretty poor season as a team, but he came over late. He was released by his old team, Punjab, because he was getting married in April, wouldn't be available for most of the season. Lucknow thought it was worth investing in him regardless and keeping him for future seasons effectively. But he's come in and scored 350s in 5 games, striking at 186. And his relationship with Mitch Marsh at the top of their order was pretty outrageous, really. They were going at 14s in the power play, smoking it all over the place. So he's been hugely impressive. I mean, I've seen a fair bit of Josh Inglis over the years. He's played some county cricket. He scored a great 100 against England in the Champions Trophy, but was hugely impressed by him. The other one I think is interesting is Cam Green has actually had a pretty solid season in the end. He was obviously came over with a huge price tag and a lot of pressure on him, and I think everyone seized on a few quiet games at the start of the comp, particularly because he wasn't bowling on Cricket Australia restrictions. But he's ended up having a pretty solid year, 320 runs, I think 7 wickets. KKR just missed out in the end on the playoffs. But yeah, having had some pretty hefty shoes to fill, and Andre Russell, he did a not bad impersonation of him this year. I guess the interesting one with an Ashes coming up in 27 and a possible World Test Championship final for Australia will be whether or not he's free and available and ready to bowl and all that sort of thing, given how intense that test workload is going to be over the next, 9 months.
Oh, I'm so glad you called him out, because it almost feel like there's a bit of confirmation bias going against Cam at the moment. If not with the media, then with the general public, that it feels like if we hear he's not going well, it almost reinforces probably the broader cricket community's impression of him at the moment, that he's been elevated despite the lack of performances. And when he does well, it's like we never hear about it. So it's nice that you've called it out there, because I'm with you. He's had a pretty reasonable tournament from where the expectations were set leading in. So that we got RCB and Gujarat, that's essentially what we would call the major semi-final. Winner goes straight through to the final. And the Sunrisers up against Rajasthan. So if people are weekly listeners of our show, Ed reacted to this the other day. He couldn't believe the fact that it's neutral site the whole way through. So not as if there's just a neutral site for the final, Matt. They're going to play at different venues. And I saw you outline on Crick Info a couple of weeks ago that it's going to be particularly challenging for the side that that loses that major semi-final.
Yeah, correct. So the venues are slightly different in terms of how they've structured it this year. But effectively, if you were to lose the first game, qualifier 1, and go and play in qualifier 2, then you're playing an opponent who's just played in the venue that you're now going to. And there's then a travel day between that and the final, no opportunity to train. So I think the smart money is probably on the team that wins that first qualification game, RCB against GT, winning the comp. The only slight possible asterisk to that is that GT would play a home game if it's the final. And have a great record at home this year. They've won 5 out of 7, so I think they would be probably marginal favourites despite the travel disadvantage. The wider question on playoff venues is an interesting one this year, because typically the way this works is that the runner-up from the previous season will host the first 2 qualifying games, and the winner will host the final 2 games, including the final. So RCB actually made a bit of a point last year when they finally got over the line with Virat Kohli winning his first IPL, of saying, you know, we're going to have an amazing opportunity next year to win it again in the Chinnaswamy. Let's get addicted to winning. Let's go back to back. But instead, for various reasons behind the scenes, that game was eventually taken off them and is now in Ahmedabad, as most major events in Indian cricket seem to be these days. So I think some frustration there. I'm not sure the state association necessarily got it quite right in terms of the number of free tickets they were asking for and all that sort of thing behind the scenes. But yeah, Gujarat have a decent chance if they can get to the final of winning it, given how strong they are in Ahmedabad.
Let's get into the themes of the tournament that we've seen present as we've gone through. So first one here concerns the power play, as to the teams that are particularly on top early in an innings and how that translates to obviously going on and ultimately getting the dub.
Yeah, it's been a really notable theme over the past probably 3 or 4 years, I'd say, at the IPL, that whereas you had a generation probably 10, 15 years ago of players who would see the 30-yard circle as the boundary rope inside the power play and would say, all I've got to do is get it over the infield and then I'm guaranteed full runs, and would be so focused on boundary hitting, you know, guys like Mike Hussey and Shaun Marsh back in the day probably taking that approach. Now it's all about sixes in the power play, and the number of sixes I think has nearly doubled in the past three seasons in the first six overs. Power play run rates have broken 10 for the first time. Teams absolutely going all guns blazing. People talk about going from ball one, but that genuinely does happen now. There's very few teams taking the first over as a sighter, and everyone's looking to get on top early. And you have seen a bigger correlation. It might sound like an obvious thing to say, you know, do well in the first third of each game and you'll obviously do well overall. But the correlation is stronger now. I think it was about 64% 2 years ago that teams that got the higher power play score go on and win the game. And it's more like 77, 78 this year. So, yeah, the teams who are struggling early on are continuing to struggle, and teams are looking at that phase of the game where there's only two men out as their huge opportunity to get ahead.
I saw your analysis on this too, with when it comes to Gujarat, about sort of doing something different and having the only two bowlers essentially take care of the full six overs during the power play as almost a little bit of a counter to that. And so far seems to be, you know, leading to good results.
Yeah, Gujarat have been a really interesting team for a couple of years now, and that they're a massive outlier. I'd say that most people think about attacking in T20 cricket and think about batters, but Gujarat have been by far the most attacking bowling team. They've got by a distance the most wickets in the tournament, and they've basically empowered two guys in Mohammad Siraj and KG Rabada, so two pretty useful new ball exponents, to run in and take control of the first six. As you say, they've taken bags of wickets between them up front. And Ashish Nehra, their coach, he's a bit of a maverick. He's quite old school. He's not sort of particularly data driven, I would say. And quite often you see him sort of standing there drinking coconut water out of the coconut. but he's effectively said he's got a theory that test match lengths are the way to counter this, in that, you know, when you have players who are trying to hit sixes all the time, if you can relentlessly do something that they're not very good at facing, because they don't do it very much. The new age T20 batters don't face the moving ball very often. And if we have two brand new ball bowlers in Rabada and Siraj, who can move it a bit off the seam and can consistently hit a length, they're not going to be well equipped to challenge that. And with the help of a little bit of their home conditions, which have suited that, they've been hugely successful and, yeah, finished second.
Do you think we'll see it replicated? Is that something that'll catch on outside of India and in T20 cricket, period?
Yeah, I think it's always a little bit conditions-based. I think, for example, that 22 T20 World Cup down in Australia, I think we saw a slightly different format of T20 to what we see most of the time, and that it was, you know, early in your summer. You did have a lot of new ball movement, and I'm sure we'll see something similar in 28 when the next T20 World Cup's down there. But yeah, I think teams going super hard in the power play is a growing worldwide trend. I think teams increasingly see that as a great opportunity to hit sixes rather than fours. And I'm sure what usually happens is that something will happen at the IPL and everyone else around the world will suddenly wake up and say, yeah, maybe we should try this too.
Just while we're on the star new ball bowlers that we're used to seeing dominating in the test arena, one guy that's dominated across formats, Jasprit Bumrah, for a long period of time now. What happened to him this IPL? That it felt like every time I jumped on in the morning and checked his numbers, it wasn't too pretty, which is something we're so unfamiliar with when it comes to one of the greats of the game.
Yeah, it's been extraordinary, really. And I mean, Mumbai Indians more generally, people will look at the team and the superstars that they have. I mean, Hardik Pandya, Surya Kumar Yadav, Rohit Sharma, Tilak Varma, Bumrah himself. It's an unbelievable team. It's near enough an India 11 at times. So for them to have underachieved to the extent they have and end up ninth is a real shocker. And yeah, Bumrah has been a really curious one. I mean, he's taken 4 wickets in 13 games, averaging over 100. Which you'd have got some seriously long odds on at the start of the comp. I suppose the interesting one with him is that his economy rate has still been pretty good. He's going at eights, which in the context of a tournament where most teams are going at tens, is pretty impressive. And there has probably been an element of teams sitting on him at times and saying, Mumbai, the rest of their attack has underperformed. Let's really go after them and knock it around to a certain extent against Bumrah. I think there has also been through this competition a real sense of post T20 World Cup fatigue among players who were involved in that, and I think probably even more so for the India players. I heard Jos Buttler draw the parallel with playing in the 2019 Ashes immediately after the home World Cup for England, and saying, despite the fact it was an Ashes series, it was such a big event, it was really hard to feel present for that and get himself up for it because of the fact that he just achieved something that he'd spent so long working towards and was such an obvious emotional high and the adrenaline of all that. And I think that's probably quite an apt comparison with these India guys. I mean, that T20 World Cup on home soil was such a big thing for them. So you can understand how they might have come into this tournament and maybe without even meaning to, subconsciously, the performance levels drop a bit. Bumrah wasn't, I don't think, 100% fit at the start of the tournament. He's been struggling a bit with his front foot and no balls. So yeah, I'm sure it to the extent that he gets a break, which he rarely does because India's calendar is so busy, I'm sure he'll appreciate that in the next week or so.
We talked a bit about Abhishek Sharma during that World Cup. For him, he was down on his usual numbers. I was, spruiking him as this guy's going to tear apart the tournament. And I think he had 3 ducks in his first 4 hits or something to get away. But he's back at it here in the IPL, along with Suryavanshi, who we talk about all the time, obviously, as the wonder kid out of India. All the time we speak about this production line. Who are the young batters coming through in India that we need to pay attention to on the back of this IPL?
Yeah, I mean, Suryavanshi's been scarcely believable at times. Like, I spend a lot of my time over here doing a studio show with ex-pros, and he's the one guy in the green room where everyone is sat up and making sure they're completely glued to the game. It's remarkable the effect that he seems to have on people. He's hit 53 sixes, which is he's six. He needs six more in the playoffs to tie the tournament record for a season, which was Chris Gayle back in 2012. Which would be a remarkable achievement for any young Indian batter, yeah. Let alone someone who's still school age.
It's incredible.
That
the age of him in particular, and I know a lot of people are debating, oh, maybe he's 2 years older or whatever. Say he is 2 years older. It's still incredible what he's doing. I can't believe how many people get hung up on that rather than the achievement where you think, well, yeah, who cares how old he is? I guess the point remains, for someone so young, he's clearly outperforming where, you'd think someone would be at that particular stage of life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, as you say, there's obviously a little bit of doubt about the exact dates, and I think he gave an interview where he hinted that he basically gave a number that would mean he would probably be 17 now rather than 15. Well, if a 17 sure. year old hitting 53 sixes in a season, as you say, it's still unbelievable. Abhishek has had another good season. He often dominates at IPL and is striking at over 200. And one other guy from Punjab Kings, a guy called Priyansh Arya, who came into the league a year or two ago, is striking at over 200 as well. Although, as we might get on to talking about the Aussies and Ricky Ponting, Punjab have had one of the all-time great collapses to fail to make the playoffs, so we won't be seeing him anymore this season.
The spinners across the board, so you talked about the pace bowlers. How have the slow bowlers gone in the 2026 IPL?
Yeah, it's been a struggle, I'd say. People would associate Indian cricket with spin, but I think the pitches are so flat now and the boundaries are so short that increasingly captains are seeing bowling spin as a big risk. Spinners are conceding more than 9 runs and over for the first time in IPL history. They're averaging 30-plus. I think a good example of this, actually, again, mentioning Punjab, was Yuzvendra Chahal, who people will remember having played a fair bit of white ball cricket for India. He's the IPL's all-time leading wicket taker, and yet Punjab in one game against GT gave him a single over because they didn't think the matchups and the conditions suited. And in one game against Delhi when they were up in Dharamsala, obviously that's a pretty extreme venue. It's at altitude. There's a lot of dew, but he played but didn't bowl a ball in that game. They didn't feel as though the opportunity was there for him. So it probably tells you something about the wider psyche at the moment around spin and just seeing it as such a big risk to toss the ball up above the eye line for these power hitters.
Our man Buff Lehman will be filthy. He'll be thinking, look, if he's not going to play over there in the IPL, he may as well come back to Northants and have a roll around for them in the county scene. Continuing to see what's been in vogue in T20 cricket worldwide, the sides that chase have had success this IPL. Are we ever going to get to a point, do you think, Matt, where they do something about that to try and tip the balance in the other direction when it comes to chasing, whether it's something different at the toss, maybe the home, the away team decides, or maybe we do something funky because it feels like the game has become so lopsided to the team that bats second.
Yeah, one of the interesting things over here actually is that they've been really trying, and I think quite successfully over the past few years, to sort of clamp down on dew as a big trend and a big factor as to why chasing has been so much more successful. So there's now a sort of anti-dew spray that gets used all the time and seems to have been relatively successful in eliminating the advantage of dew specifically. But I think the way the game is set up and the way particularly teams are attacking the power play so hard to try and get ahead of run chases just means that it regardless, despite that, you've still had, I think, what, 63%, I've got written down, of completed games have been won by the chasing team, which is a lot. And yeah, it will be interesting to see whether that's something that sort of sends alarm bells out. You don't want these games getting predictable, and particularly with the way that tempo of innings has changed with, as I said, teams trying to get ahead of the run chase early. That has had the result of there being probably fewer close games and more games where you could switch on as a casual fan midway through the second innings and think, well, they're miles ahead of the rate here. They've got some wickets left. There's no chance that this is going to go deep. I don't really know what the answer would be in terms of the toss winner almost always wants to chase these days. I think we've only had two games this year where a team has successfully defended having chosen themselves to bat first. So it's not something that anyone wants to do, really. But yeah, I think this is the best ever season for chasing teams in terms of most wins. And we've obviously still got four games left there.
Should we do away with the toss? Is that something they can look at? Whether it's the away team decides or something funky?
Yeah, I don't know what the solution would be in terms of I think part of the problem as well is just the time of day that these games happen. Yeah. We've seen a real trend in the afternoon, actually. The afternoon games have almost entirely been won by chasing teams because it starts under the blazing sun. The pitch is generally a bit stoppy at the front and then gets lovely to bat on a little later in the evening. So I think those afternoon games are probably more of a one to watch. I mean, the broadcasters don't like them anyway because the viewing figures are way down. So who knows? There's lots of talk about making the IPL longer, and that's been a conversation that's been had for several years now and hasn't yet happened. But if they make it longer, then to have any kind of management of the window, you're probably going to have to see more afternoon games. And I think generally that those are pretty dull and pretty predictable. And as a result, people don't like watching them as much.
What is home ground counted for in IPL 2026?
A lot. The best three teams, RCB, GT and SRH, are the three that have done best at home. One of the interesting sort of subplots within this is that a lot of teams use multiple home venues and generally those ones have struggled, RCB being the only exception really. But it'll generally be because of some official at the franchise or someone who has involvement in BCCI politics will have a reason that a team plays a couple of games at a second venue. So, for example, Rajasthan are mainly based in Jaipur but play a few games in Guwahati. You have Punjab play four home games in Chandigarh and then went to Dharamsala for a week for three home games there, lost all three of those. So I think that is a big trend because, you know, you go into an auction, you pick a team that you think can win at your primary home venue, and then suddenly the conditions at your secondary home venue are quite different. It's been a real struggle. There's also been a bit of talk about pitches and whether or not teams should or shouldn't have control, and it does seem to be a little bit inconsistent across the league. The sort of general sense is that the BCCI have ultimate control and that you're in theory trying to produce the best pitch possible, but you certainly have teams like GT are the masters of this, and Ahmedabad, who choose the right pitch for the right opposition. They have different soil types of that venue, and if they're playing against a team that they don't think is as powerful, they'll play on red, whereas if they think that they can get on top of them, they'll go a black soil pitch and do them with the ball. So they've been very impressive in how they've managed it. By contrast, you then have the Delhi coach Hemang Badani saying that, you know, we're treating every game like an away game because we have no idea how any of these strips are going to play. So I think you probably do need some kind of tightening there in terms of making it universal across the board, and maybe just say to the franchises, look, if you want to hire a groundsman for these 8 weeks, that's fine. As long as you don't dig up the rest of the square and do anything crazy, you prepare the pitch that you want.
It reminds me, I was in Nagpur for the first test of the last time Australia toured there, and they got there, and outside the off stump, I think it was to the left-hander, and the Aussies had a bunch of left-handers at the time. There was almost a pre-prepared rough that all of a sudden appeared on one side of the pitch at Nagpur. So some funky stuff can go on from time to time. We have a similar situation here. I think the Sydney Thunder and the Melbourne Renegades both play some home games away, but generally that's more a financial thing. You know, they'll go to Canberra and they'll go to Geelong. I can't imagine the IPL teams are short of a buck. So as you said, there's a few more sort of political posturing perhaps at play there. You alluded to Punjab. So this was incredible the way that they fell apart. They almost had the opposite of KKR's year, where KKR started slow and came home with the wet sail for Punjab, led by our man Ricky Ponting. They were in a finals position most of the way through, and then completely fell off in the back end of the year.
Yeah, they did. It's been unequivocally the greatest collapse in IPL history. No team had ever gone seven games unbeaten at the start of the season, as Punjab did. So no team had definitely ever gone seven games unbeaten and then failed to qualify for the playoffs. They were never below fifth this season. They were always in the mix in four spots for the playoffs. But yeah, just went on this horrible losing streak, effectively. I mean, their catching was a major issue. And this, I would say the fielding has not been great this season in IPL. But Punjab, the real outlier in terms of just how poor it was. They had one game against Sunrisers where I think they dropped three catches and missed a stumping in the space of four overs, which when you're playing against one of the most dominant batting teams in the league is pretty unforgivable. They haven't taken enough wickets. They're taking on average 5 wickets a game. I think they've only bowled two balls in the season to number nine or below batters. So constantly bowling to set batters at the end, which has been a big problem for them. They have a really powerful batting lineup and have got 200 a lot, but they're also conceding 200 all the time. And I think, you know, T20 does sometimes produce these odd seasons where a team gets on a roll right at the start and then has had the complete opposite effect in the second half. But yeah, it has been incredible. They've been chasing their tail in selection, making lots of changes in the second half, which they didn't do in the first. They actually won their final game, which people thought might have just been enough for them to scrape through, but then Rajasthan got a big win against Mumbai on Sunday afternoon, which, yeah, Punjab would have been watching in the team room hoping that Mumbai could do them a favour, and it didn't happen. So now going to have to reflect on how they have completely thrown away, yeah, a position of 13 points after seven games and end the season on 15 after 14.
I look through their draw too. They had a pretty good draw. So each team plays 14 games, which means there's 10 teams in the competition. So you got to play the other nine once, and then you essentially play five teams twice. They didn't even play eventual finalists Rajasthan or the league leaders and the defending champs RCB twice. So they actually had a softer draw as such when they didn't have to play as many of the top teams in it, and ultimately weren't able to convert after a 7-0 start or undefeated through their first seven games with that no result. And the Aussie coaches in particular, so I know Justin Langer's team seems to be under a fair bit of pressure. His job obviously at the Lucknow Supergiants, and Ricky Ponting's not long in the job, and that's a bit of a puzzling year for them. But what do you make of the Aussie gaffers, I guess as you would call them in the UK?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens in both cases. I think Ponting has a lot of credit in the bank. Punjab had a massive rebuild for his first season. They only retained two players before the mega auction a couple of years ago. Were losing finalists in a relatively tight final with RCB last year. So I'd be surprised if anything happened with Ponting. I think Langer, there's probably more of a conversation, but Lucknow have been a curious franchise for a while. They're captained by Rishabh Pant, who's on huge money and has underperformed for a couple of years, made some pretty baffling tactical calls at times. So I think he's definitely under scrutiny. They've also introduced Tom Moody this year as director of cricket, who I think is a great operator. But interesting that he's sort of come in mid-cycle, I suppose, on top of Langer in a slightly different role. Pant has alluded a couple of times to this sense that he has that there's too many voices this year. So they also have Kane Williamson as an advisor. They have Lance Klusener, who's a head coach in various leagues, as one of their assistants, and clearly have quite a few people in leadership roles in that dugout, including him. But yeah, wouldn't be at all surprised given that they finished last with a wooden spoon. If there's a bit of a leadership change there, I think Pant is the more vulnerable than Langer, but be interested to see which way they go. And I think there's a decent chance actually that Mitch Marsh will end up captaining them next season, having had a pretty standout year with the bat.
So Wednesday, RCB up against Gujarat. That's the major semi-final. And then Thursday, Sunrisers play Rajasthan. And then it all happens pretty quickly from there. So winner of the minor semi-final plays the loser of the major semi. And then obviously they go through to play the winner of the major semi-final on Sunday. So it's all done and dusted pretty quick from here. So we'll keep a lookout for that. Have you got a quick pick for us? Who wins the whole thing, Matt?
Think it'll be Gujarat. I
Ooh,
think
okay.
having the final on their home ground is such a big advantage that they're my favourites.
And just a nice light one to finish. Have you been following the privatisation conversation from afar about Cricket Australia looking to try and offload the BBL teams?
I have, and with interest as well, because we've obviously gone through something similar in the UK. I think the two processes seem to be slightly different, but also pretty similar. I think they're both being run by the Rain Group. There seems to be slightly more skepticism by the seams of things in Australian cricket. And I think my sense is that the two boards are probably trying to solve slightly different problems. I think a lot of the situation back home in the UK was we have a pretty new product. The 100 was only 4 seasons old when they were looking to sell, which we think is worth a lot of cash and we think can solve the funding problem at county level, which is quite widespread, and we can, effectively solve the cash problems that have affected the county game for a while, and we can put an end to that for the next 20, 25 years. I feel like in Australia, it's slightly less obvious what problem would be solved, other than potentially this sort of dream that the Big Bash can involve all of the top Australian players, which I'm not sure would necessarily happen immediately if privatisation happens, and the sort of slight sense that the Big Bash has declined over a period of time with the emergence of leagues in South Africa and the UAE, but I don't really see it being quite as cut and dry as it was back home in terms of, this is the obvious solution and this is what we must do, and there being widespread support for it, definitely.
I think clearly the issue here too, we've got different states that want different things. So some states that are hard up for cash, they're understandably keen to sell to solve a short-term interest, whereas the states that aren't too bad financially are probably looking at it thinking, hang on, we only get a chance to sell it once, and then once we've sold it, it's gone. And so are there other ways that we can, raise the capital to put more money into the Big Bash to make it bigger and greater before we worry about doing all these things, which, one of them, as you said, if you want your top Australian guys playing at it, we can do that overnight. We can find a window, we can move games around and be able to have them available immediately just by changing the schedule. Is there any buyer's remorse, do you think? I know there was a lot of consternation in Manchester when the logo changed and everything else. Do you get any sense of that from the ECB or from some of the counties?
I don't think so at this stage, but I think it'll be more. I think the interesting thing with Cricket Australia's process coming so soon after the ECB's is that there isn't really too much of an opportunity to sort of see how it goes in England before potentially getting involved in Australia, and that might be a reason for some of the delays that we've seen. I think it will be very interesting to see this summer whether the 100 looks noticeably different in venue. And whether there's any sense that, I suppose one of the big differences is that whereas it's quite viable and likely that people have become, let's say, a Brisbane Heat fan if you live in Queensland over the past, what, 15 plus years, I don't think there are at this stage that many sort of Manchester originals diehards who are, outraged about the potential for a kit change and becoming the super giants, just simply because it's not existed for long enough. But yeah, it will be interesting to see how the dynamics play out. And obviously, we have a split back home in terms of IPL owners versus non-IPL owners. So I think that has generally been a bit of a dividing line in terms of the IPL owners probably wanting things to happen one way, the others wanting something to happen a slightly different way. I think an interesting figure who I'm pretty sure you'll have mentioned on the pod before is John Knox in all of this, who's the chair of Cricket New South Wales. He's obviously involved in Aries Management, who are involved in the Trent Rockets. And he's obviously had a sort of front row seat in all of these discussions, in that he's seen exactly what's happened in the UK. And I think it's notable, therefore, that Cricket New South Wales have taken the stance they have, with him obviously heavily involved in and having seen both processes. So, yeah, it's been interesting to track it from afar, and it'll be interesting to see exactly which route they go down, whether it's partial sale, full sale, no sale. yeah, interesting times in Australian cricket.
Absolutely. We'll be following it closely here with Ed every week. I'm sure he's particularly passionate. This is his area with the cricket and business crossover. Matt, you're an absolute weapon. I know you haven't had one day off just about since you got to Mumbai, and on your first day off, here you are getting up early to chat to me in Australia. So I appreciate your time as always on the ABC Cricket Podcast, and hopefully we chat again before too long. Appreciate your time.
Not at all. Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
That is Matt Rowler from ESPN Cricket Info. I appreciate his time and appreciate your time for listening right here on the ABC Cricket Podcast. Don't forget, ABC Cricket Podcast at abc.net.au. That is our email address if you want to get in touch with us. That's ABC Cricket Podcast at abc.net.au. Ed Cowan will be back next week. So send through your questions and any queries that you have for Ed, and I'll put them to him next Monday on the show when we chop it all up from everything going on in the world of cricket right here on the ABC Cricket Podcast.